Hi, loves. Welcome to Module 8. We've got a couple of weeks talking about coaching with conflict, and then we'll take a break for a week before we come in for the last couple of modules, which I think is going to be really cool. So Module 8 kind of sees us move into we're sort of turning the corner, if you like, from looking at self-doubt into actually, what does it mean to build self-belief, self-trust, self-worth, self-acceptance? How do we help our clients to actually do that? It is a question that I have spent hours and hours and hours and hours wrestling with. And what I found is that actually there isn't a lot of evidence-based approaches to this. You'd think there would be, right? But when it comes to what we even mean by self-belief, self-doubt, self-trust, self-worth, and self-acceptance, those healthy self-resources, there's kind of conflict within the literature, within the research, and what I have found is that when it comes to actually supporting our clients, it's where we kind of meet the tension of academic research and pragmatic practitioner-led tools. And what I'm hoping is that the next few modules will give you some real ways of actually applying the research that we know about when it comes to these things. So I've spent the most of the last decade developing these tools. And when I created SBCA, it was really interesting because I realized that I sort of don't really use tools in the traditional sense. I just ask questions and have conversations with clients. So it was a really interesting process of listening back over dozens and dozens of calls with people to see what did I ask, what helped. What did we do? What does the research say? And kind of using this as a way into giving you some really effective ways of supporting clients. Yeah. So the conflict tools that we look at are really, I think, quite interesting because we kind of come up against this our own unconscious desire to not look at conflict. This is shared by all the researchers, right? So it's why a lot of conflict-based kind of approaches are not actually that helpful. So what I'm wanting us to do today, hey Cassie, nice to see you. What I'm wanting us to do today is have a little look at conflict, and to do this sort of through the lens of our own relationship with conflict, because as we know, that is going to impact how we approach this with our clients. And then next week we're going to talk more about how do we work with this phenomena with our clients. Okay, so today we're going to look at the aims of this module, your relationship with conflict. We're going to do a bit of coaching if that comes up. We'll have more of a kind of open discussion and set some ideas for your practice pods to play with this stuff. So the aim of this module is to explore our relationship with conflict, right? Because with anything and any approach that I'm offering you, I want you to be interested in your own experience of it. Because there's so little, like, real world evidence-led tools around this stuff, your presence in the face of coaching with the clients' fears and doubts and worries around conflict are going to have a massive impact on how effective this is. because our main aim is to support our clients to explore their relationship with conflict, right? So we start with us. We're going to talk about styles of conflict, the experience of emotions, which is a big thing that comes up when it comes to conflict, and explore some of the tools that we can use to resource clients when things like judgment and criticism and confrontation come up in their lives. And really what we're doing here is talking about practices that get us to a place where we accept conflict, that becomes our conflict style as self-belief coaches, where we don't actually see anything wrong with conflict. It's part of human relations. And so we have these practices that help us to get to that place. So the reason why I want to start with our relationship with conflict is because all of this is dependent on your feelings around it. So for us, I believe, for us to show up as self-belief coaches and our healthy selves, we need to have some peace around our own relationship with conflict. Yeah. So what do you think of conflict? Well, when you think about conflict, what comes up for you? Who wants to offer? Builders outside. Yeah, okay. Go for it.
So I kind of have learned in my life that conflict is good because it brings us together. Like one of my very first therapists in my early 20s, like that time she always said there are like pigeons and there are, I don't know what the other one was, wolves or something. The pigeons are avoiding conflict in relationships and the wolves, they are like kind of like happy to fight and they live also, like they experience closeness in conflict. And for me, that was a total new concept. I'm coming from a family of like, we don't have problems. And if we have, they are like, you know, they are not there. They know that it's kind of like it's a big problem if there's a conflict that we have to avoid it at all costs. And I've learned in my life that actually learning to be just open and ready for people not to agree is so much more nice, alive, peaceful than avoiding to be honest and then always having this kind of like stone in the gut and the kind of the weird feeling. And so I like, yeah, I've just learned this. And I lived for 7 years in meditation retreats. And so we were like people who did not choose each other. And it was kind of like, you know, usually you go on holiday with people you choose, but being locked in for years with people you didn't choose, there was, of course, a lot of that. And we have tried all kinds of methods to find a way to agree on a style to deal with it. And basically the people who were open and kind when there were conflicts, they had a good time in the group. And the people who did not know how to do this, they felt always kind of weird. So yeah, I think it's an important thing and I'm happy you are including it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Anke. Anyone else have maybe, I have a very different experience to you, Anke. So I'm interested in what comes up. Yeah, Kirsty.
I think there's a kind of conflicting approach for me, in that, you know, I've worked in HR for 25 years and you can't avoid conflict in that type of role, but it's very rarely conflict that actually involves me. I'm the facilitator. So zero fear of conflict between other people, and, you know, quite adept at diffusing situations and kind of, you know, helping managers to navigate those conversations. And then I think in my personal life, I think I probably run screaming in the other direction from it and avoid at all costs bringing up a topic that might cause conflict. And I think, I know it's like quite often in these sessions, I bring up my sister, because we all have a very difficult relationship with Heidi, and but no one will tell her. And it's not my fear of conflict. It's my knowledge of how she will react to perceived conflict in that we would probably never hear from her again. There's a massive brick wall, so the rest of us just avoid it completely. And then I'm trying to think about, I think in my relationship with my husband, it's if there's something that is potentially, you know, a thorny issue, I'll wait until emotion has gone from the situation, because I handle conflict a lot better once the initial emotion has gone away. So it's much more kind of measured approach. But again, I will choose to bury things under the carpet as well. So I'm a real mixed bag.
Yeah, love that. It's so interesting, isn't it, how we are in the face of other people's conflict versus our own experience as well. Yeah, I think that's really common. Yeah, really common. Thanks, Kirsty. Cass, do you want to add anything?
I think as I've matured, I have become conflict averse. Yeah. Whereas in my younger years, and certainly my 20s, I think partly from circumstance, I had two very conflict heavy relationships, and I thought that was, you know, the way that you should express everything was to be screamy and shouty and to get the attention. Yeah. And as a teenager, I was a bit like that. I was very much a stomp in my feet teenager. But then now as I've got older, now I'm like, oh no, it makes me feel really uncomfortable. I'll avoid anything that I feel could become conflict in any way, shape or form, whether it be a big emotional outburst or just a bit of an uncomfortable energy.
Yeah So interesting. I kind of relate to all of you, like all of your experiences, Cassie. I think when I was younger, just trying to get my voice heard in my family was really hard. We didn't have any secret emotions. Everyone just had their emotions out on the table, and for someone who was quite sensitive, I didn't know how to manage that, so I responded with a lot of my emotion. And yeah, conflict was deeply encouraged in our family, often under the influence of alcohol, which was not great. But it was kind of almost worn as a badge of honor. And I remember growing up with my dad, who would always refer to his passionate Italian roots as to why he was so verbose and quite adversarial. I did one of those 23andMe things. We have absolutely no Italian heritage in our family. So I don't know where that myth comes from. And Kirsty, what you're describing about, you know, being around other people's conflict, but having a much more, tumultuous or a bit more of a, and when I'm invested, or I say something that causes conflict, or there's a risk of that, I'm much more tentative around it. Anka, that the when I'm in my healthy self, I'm like, yep, down with it, bring it on. It's all good. So healthy. We should have the conversation. And I can kind of, you know, manage that really well and repair it quite well. And I'm learning, I think it's a lifelong learning thing around how to be in that place of accepting that conflict is just a normal part of human relationships. The reason that we are including this in this program is because if you look at the psychological risks that self-doubt is protecting us and our clients from, half of them are to do with conflict, you know, judgment, criticism, rejection. Conflict is one. So of the kind of 7-8, you know, risks that we know of that are those real core reasons why we hold ourselves back, why our clients hold themselves back, you know, most of them are to do with the risk of conflict. And I suspect that is because very few of us have grown up in homes where conflict was modeled in a healthy way. And we are kind of, you know, socialized as women to never be angry. That is, anger is something to be avoided at all costs. There's a price we pay for that, and to raise conflict is to be seen as, you know, if you're a woman, attention seeking, or you know, just stirring the pot, all of these things that kind of, all of these kind of, you know, projected reasons why we might say, yeah, drama queen, yeah, why we might actually, you know, induce some conflict. And I think the thing that happens is that as I have got to know, like, what is it that sparks up our client's self-doubt, what activates it, the risk of conflict is huge. And our clients are spending an enormous amount of energy trying to avoid conflict. So there is a lot of conflict that isn't happening because of the energy that's expelled trying to avoid it. We tie ourselves in knots trying not to have conflict. Equally, there is this kind of perceived risk of conflict where even things like, and I just use this example, you know, clients that worry, if I post something on Instagram and I say the wrong thing, I'll be cancelled. You know, that's a kind of new phenomena. And it is a real risk because that is a thing. And yet, you know, the things that they're talking about posting are really not controversial. So we kind of, self-doubt is like inviting us to believe these worst case scenarios. And if we are sensitive to conflict, if our clients are sensitive to conflict and the whole spectrum of it, from judgment to confrontation, we will do whatever we need to do to hold ourselves back from that risk. And the thing that we do when we do that, when our clients do that, is that we miss out on all the benefits of conflict. We miss out on all the benefits of it because it means that we aren't kind of raising issues that need to be addressed. We're not saying when a boundary is being crossed. We're not letting people know that, or letting ourselves know even, oh, there's a value here of mine that's being diminished. Maybe I'm outgrowing this relationship, or there's some aspect of my life that's kind of not feeling quite right anymore because I'm ready for something new, or there's, you know, there's some other thing that is calling me. So I think for us to show up and support clients to recognize it, just because they're having emotions that might be difficult, doesn't necessarily mean that they are at risk. And for us to be able to do that, we need to be pretty unentangled around conflict. Because you can imagine if a client comes to you and says, I have a huge amount of self-doubt about my boss and my relationship with my boss. They are very adversarial and I can't deal with that. And if you also find people who are very confrontational and adversarial really difficult to deal with, there's not much healthy coaching going on. And what we know about self-doubt is that the risk of conflict is massive. So this is going to come up. It probably already has with clients where, you know, they don't want to go after the thing that they want because of all the people that it's going to inconvenience. They don't want to have a difficult conversation. They are, you know, expelling all of this energy that could be put into building something, avoiding the thing that they think is going to happen. Yeah. So I'm curious to know, have either or any of you had a look at the different conflict styles, the four main conflict styles? If you haven't, just say you haven't, or you'd like a refresher, because I think it might be helpful to just kind of review that today and get a sense of what your conflict style is, and we can kind of talk about then what we do around that. Yeah, does that sound helpful? Yeah. Anger, it sounds like you're a bit more recently caught up. So hopefully this will be a nice kind of refreshery chat. Okay, so this is based on Thomas Kalman's conflict model, which I just find of all of the ones I've looked at is pretty good. It's pretty helpful. I've changed some of the names and I've added this, you know, kind of looked at this through the lens of self-doubt. Because I think that can be quite helpful just so we know what to expect from our clients. There's four main conflict styles. I'm going to go through them, and I just want you to sort of have a sense in your mind, oh, okay, right, that's probably me. Most of us have one that is our go-to, and then we might have another that we sort of, you know, add as a supplementary helper, right? So accommodating and avoidant. On the left-hand side, these are the most common that we will see with clients with self-doubt. See what you think. I'll go around these in a kind of circle. So we'll start with accommodating. So the characteristics of an accommodating conflict style is that we tend to be quite cooperative in relationships generally. And we might have a hard time kind of valuing our own point of view or standing up for our own ideas, that kind of thing. It's like, it's okay, I'm relaxed, low maintenance vibes, right? We might be quite hesitant to separate from others or to risk that separation. So in order to preserve the relationship, we kind of diffuse tension and we keep others happy and we make sure we defer to other people's preferences. Yeah. Anyone kind of going, yeah, accommodating, kind of feeling that. Yeah, got a bit of that. So the thing about all of these styles is that they have intelligences and real advantage, and they also have limitations and drawbacks, right? So there's not what we actually want is the intelligence of all of them, is the middle one, the accepting style. So the intelligence of an accommodating style is that it is so valued in a family, a team, any dynamic where there's a group of people. Usually you're interested in helping other people, listening to other people's opinions. This is really effective and necessary in any group. You're highly likely to value generosity and caring for other people. And you usually want to create a pretty positive atmosphere, look out for others, be quite flexible, willing to adapt. You know, that flexibility is fantastic in a group and in a family kind of dynamic, in a relationship of any kind. So there's real intelligence to an accommodating style. It means that you can, you know, when that's in a healthy mode, it's like pretty flexible and, you know, you can kind of relax into the group and it's about, you know, the collective rather than the individual. And this can swing into the limitations and drawbacks where you might feel like you don't really know your own preferences, your own ideas, your own opinions. You might believe that you are valued because of the role you play in taking care of other people. And this can also reflect a bit of that martyr-y tendency, that martyr-y protector, where you start to feel a bit resentful because your contribution isn't acknowledged. Someone else might either receive the credit or kind of railroad your ideas. And it's bloody exhausting, much like that martyr protector, trying to keep everybody happy. Lots of people kind of burn out from this if they are surrounded by folks who are a bit adversarial. Yeah. So there's some real intelligence and there's some drawbacks, yeah, to an accommodating style. The adversarial style tends to be a bit competitive or combative, always up for a debate. Willingness to stand for your values, defend a position, usually quite an energetic person, and conflict feels like an opportunity to sort of express your opinions, your will, your ideas. Anyone feel like adversarial is a style or a sub-style? Can be, Kirsty. Yeah. I think younger me was probably way more adversarial. I was a bit like, and it's sometimes it's context specific as well. So like I worked in quite a male dominated environment. So it was sort of a way to almost like meet the energy that I was surrounded by. I don't know if you found this, Cass, in the hospitality industry as well. Oh. Yeah. There's some real advantages and intelligence to an adversarial style. It is really catalyzing and quite life-affirming to be around someone who knows how they feel and can assert their opinions, right? Especially when we agree with them, right? Like, yes, you can say that on behalf of me. Yeah. Not so great sometimes when we disagree. These are necessary skills for leadership often, right? So setting a limit, preserving your integrity, drawing a boundary, like being able to say, look, this is what I think we're going to do and all of that. These are the things that we look for in leaders. When they are the only skill the person has, it can be too much. But when it's in the context of empathy and, you know, a more collaborative approach, you know, when that adversarial nature is like, look, I'm defending this to the hilt because I know it's the right thing to do, when it's values led, that can be really great. It can be really liberating. Anchor, share away.
I just wanted to add, my husband has this quality and I totally lack it, and it's wonderful in relationship, like especially with the accommodating person together, because one person is not afraid to bring up something and also to stand for something, and that allows me to also feel more what actually I want, like exactly what you say, like the accommodating easily does not feel what they want. They are like, it's safer to stay open because then it's kind of easier going. But if the other person's adversarial, it's really, really wonderful to collaborate in some way. So like often the adversarial people I know, they feel bad about it in some way, a little bit ashamed sometimes, but I feel in combination with the right people, it's perfect. And also with acceptance of it.
Yeah, totally. Well, and you know what it's like if you've got two accommodators on a date, what do you want to do? Oh, I don't know. What do you want to do? And they just sit there having that conversation for 3 hours and then go, this was awesome. I did not feel triggered at all, right? It's like, amazing. Yeah, exactly. It's quite liberating, I think. And you're right, Ankit, when you have really important relationships in your life where the conflict style is quite different, that can be hugely inspiring. It can give us permission to experiment with styles that maybe don't come so naturally to us. Really cool. And you also mentioned there are some drawbacks, right? So it can, if someone is really adversarial without empathy, it can put everyone in a bit of a state of unease. It's like, well, not quite sure which version of you I'm getting today. Yeah, Kirsty.
I've had a really interesting thought as we've been going through this. And I think an area for me where there could potentially be a lot of conflict is around my veganism. Because it seems to be a really triggering subject for an awful lot of people. And it's something I feel unbelievably strongly about. So you would think from what you were saying about, you know, values and stuff, I naturally would want to be almost adversarial about it, but I absolutely haven't. I have become avoidant of it, you know, to the point that I don't even really post anything on social media. Occasionally I'll post pictures of like, here's a cute piglet in the whole, like, you know, a live one. You know, I would never post slaughterhouse footage ever, you know, and I unfollow other vegans that do, because it's like, I don't need to see that. But I'll post like, here's a cute this. And so I've taken that approach to avoid any potential conflict, because it's one of those weird topics that seems to really, really piss people off. And so I was thinking, when you were talking earlier, I was thinking about, you know, relationships and that sort of thing. And I'm like, actually, there's this, it's a massive part of my life. It's like a philosophy that I live by, but I don't very often say very much about it. So I've really taken, and my husband can be quite adversarial in person around the veganism, because we both are, about the veganism, but he wouldn't do it on social media because that, it doesn't feel like the right way. But he'll go toe to toe with somebody who wants to have a discussion about it, whereas I just like, I just avoid it completely. Even though, I mean, I've been in situations, and I do say to people now, because I have this particular affinity with pigs, like if we go out for dinner with people who eat meat, I'm fine with you eating meat, but would you mind just please this once not having the pork chop, because I'll burst into tears. Like, I'm not going to get angry with you, but I will burst into tears. And I can't cope with bacon or sausages on a plate in front of me anymore. It's really weird. I ate it for 45 years. And so that's about as far as I'll go. And apart from my father, most people will respect that. It's like, yeah, I'll have the pork tomorrow. Like, just this one meal out with Kirsty. My dad ordered a rabbit when he came to stay here with its head on it. Now, I know it's not a pig, but it's like the least vegan-friendly meat option ever, the rabbit that came with the head on it. And we both sat there like...
Very adversarial action from dad.
Totally. And we both avoided it completely. We didn't say a word. And then just giggled to ourselves, because then he didn't eat it because he had the head on it and he was grossed out by that. And I'm like, oh, I give up. I just give up. Anyway, that's a whole other subject. So it's something that's like so, so important to me. And yet I've taken a totally avoidant approach to any conflict with that.
Well, and I think that is the message from these styles, is that what we do is we go, that feels comfortable, I'll use it in every context.
Mm.
Right? So I'm comfortable avoiding. That's safest. So I'll just do that whenever there's conflict.
Hmm.
What we want to help our clients do is expand into the intelligence and us too, right? The intelligence of all of them. So this is great. I'm loving that this is stirring something up for you, Kirsty. It's such a beautiful example, right? Of where we actually do want to be a bit adversarial, but the natural tendency is, this is how I deal with it. So this is any conflict, this is my style. Yeah, really cool. So just to kind of come back to the drawbacks, the limitations of that adversarial style, is that what can happen, and Kirsty, I think you gave a great example of this when you were talking about your family member, is that you kind of end up cutting yourself off from someone who is adversarial, because we don't want to risk arguments. We don't want to risk the volatility. So for someone who is quite adversarial, they may end up believing that they have more support than they actually do. People don't support you. They're just walking on eggshells around you and accommodating you because you're a bit scary, actually. Your adversarial nature is a bit too much. The other thing that adversarial style can lead to is that you treat other people as if they are adversaries. So you just kind of rock up to any conversation ready for a fight, ready for an argument. And we've probably all worked with folks like that or met people like that in our lives where you just think, oh, you're quite hard to be around, quite sort of like, right, who's ready for a fight? Yeah, Anke.
I think it just thinking about people, like the difficult thing I think is if somebody's adversarial, but they don't know about it, they think they are accommodating or avoiding or something, and that becomes then kind of feels passive aggressive because you can't do anything about it. Like the front you get is kind of like the whatever, but behind it, one feels the actual thing one has to do, kind of.
Well, and we can do something about it. So Leah, let's talk about that too when we get to it. I think the other thing about the adversarial style is that it's really common for people with that style to find it quite difficult to relax and enjoy themselves because they're braced the whole time, looking for who's gonna challenge me. So it can feel quite lonely. Being that adversarial can be a bit isolating for people. But and because they will often have that style, there is this kind of tendency for other people to avoid confrontation with them. So it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where the conversations that people have are often, you know, challenging them because their style is so challenging. Yeah. Let's step over to avoidant for a moment. And again, this is one of the most common ones that folks with self-doubt have. And this is sort of characterized by a tendency to sort of walk away or disappear rather than face conflict. If you've ever been on a dating site and been ghosted, it's likely you're dealing with someone with an avoidant conflict style. They just can't tell you. Not into you. They can't utter those words, right? So it can be seen as willful ignorance, right? You can sort of see it like that. And I know I've had clients who have talked about a partner who has multiple infidelities that they won't address, you know, but they bring that sense of anger and betrayal to the coaching session, but there is a block with, you know, avoiding any kind of confrontation. Things like, you know, failing to notice that your partner is cheating on you, failing to notice that your teenager isn't at school again, zoning out instead of talking about a problem, that kind of sort of ability to avoid and leave even when you're in the room. Just don't see it, don't look at it, don't talk about it. There's real intelligence to an avoidance style, real intelligence, because there is a tendency to have the ability to kind of empathically read the room and get a sense of what is actually risky. So people with an avoidance style will tend to have skills in being quite diplomatic, you know, postponing an issue until a time when emotions are just a bit less fraught or a little less hot, you know, being able to say, hey, let's talk about this later, let's just give ourselves a break from this. Also, some conflicts will dissipate on their own if we allow them to. A few will, not all of them. And walking away can sometimes be the absolute right and best thing to do. So there's no doubt that having that in your toolkit is brilliant, right? Just knowing when to say, now's not a good time. This isn't going to get us anywhere, because one or both of us or all of us are too... we've lost our ability to reason and to empathize with each other. That's a great skill for someone to call that out. However, that can tip over into a sort of unhealthy version of avoidance, where we sort of withdraw from relationships that contain a lot of difference or conflict or things that we don't want to know about the other person. It also means things like we can hold back from contributing to conversations where we might get some feedback, because we interpret all feedback as criticism. So let's just avoid any time that we might get some feedback. And we can also offer that becomes a disservice as well. Like, what if we need to give our client feedback that isn't going to be welcomed? How do we do that? How do we give feedback in a way that doesn't sever the relationship if we know that they're sensitive to that? There's a lot of energy that is spent resisting or suppressing any kind of conflict when you're avoidant. And it also can take a bit of toll on your self-worth, because you end up feeling a bit helpless, like there's nothing I can do. My only option is to bolt. And it's interesting, I think my natural tendency is probably avoidant, accommodating, a bit of a combo of those, which is not great. I learned the most about that style and healing that style from working with horses, coaching with horses, equine therapy. So if you've ever met a horse, they are prey animals. Their only means of keeping themselves safe is to bolt. That's why they can run so fast. And horses have an enormous limbic system. So while we have a large prefrontal cortex and our limbic system is smaller, the horse is reversed. So they're incredibly sensitive to energy. And all they are doing with their little ears is scanning the environment. Right? You see a horse's ears. And all they're doing is, are you safe? Are you not safe? Are you safe? Are you not safe? They're feeling into the coherence of your energy. And I spent a few times now over the last decade, I've spent time with horses in that equine therapy context. And I had an encounter with a horse who, we just went into a corral, and we invited the horse to teach us, It's quite magical. Kirsty, I think you would love this because of your affinity with animals, but it was quite magical. And the horse reacted, six of us in the group, the horse reacted completely differently to all of us. And we were just in there for like 10 minutes. And my encounter, the horse came, and I think the horse's name was Cassie, if I remember correctly. So that's very sweet, Cass. The horse came up to me and did an enormous poo right in front of me, like almost at my feet, and then kind of flipped it, not at me, but kind of away from me, and then sort of walked around me and kept walking through the poo. And the therapist said, "What are you seeing?" And I was like, I don't know. I've just been shat on. I don't know, kind of thing. And he said, because this isn't normal horse behavior. Horses poo and leave. They're like, this is not something they want to play with. What's the message you're getting? What are you witnessing? Like, just be very literal. And I'm like, well, he just keeps going into his shit. And I was like, oh my God, that's what I do. I avoid any conflict. But what I do is go over it and over it and over it. And I never kind of walk away. I'm just circling around it the whole time. And it was this like full body kind of realization, oh, that's what I'm doing. And the horse did very different things with everyone else in the group. It was utterly fascinating. And they're just mirrors. They just reflect what they pick up from us. So I walked away from that going, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to, you know, deal with the poo. I'm going to learn how to shovel it and put it in the right place so I don't keep walking back through it. So I'm not going to avoid it anymore. And it was an incredibly powerful, like, realization just to have that mirrored back to me. And I think that's what we can do as coaches. We don't have to take a poo in front of a client, but sorry, this is getting kind of a bit scatological. But the idea is that, you know, we can reflect back to our client, hey, what do you think it is that you're doing? What's the impact of that? What choices do you have? Right? So that avoidant tendency can be a really, in that it will take a toll on self-worth if it's not tended to. When it is, it can skyrocket self-worth because we learn that, oh, I do have some choices. I can advocate for myself. I can do something different other than just walk away. Yeah. The last style is passive aggressive, and that is a mix of avoidant and adversarial. Right. So when it doesn't feel safe to express anger or resentment or resistance or make a direct request of someone, our conflict gets expressed indirectly. Right. So it's passive aggressive. It can be quite humorous and creative. Passive aggressive aggressiveness is at the heart of satire. It's at the heart of a lot of great humor. Like it's, you know, it can be really funny. And it's a great skill to kind of embrace, right? If you can make a joke, but not at someone's expense. So there's a real intelligence to that passive aggressive nature because it can be a really safe way to express your opinions if you're at the wrong end of a power dynamic. Right? So you can do things like ignore emails, turn in reports late, forget to arrange meetings for a boss who you believe is demeaning you. Right? Like you can do that. That's a passive aggressive style of dealing with it. But because it's about being kind of indirectly angry, indirectly create conflict, it will eat away at trust. Because you're not actually saying what's going on. You're indirectly kind of scooping around it. Yeah. So I'm curious to know, like, of those four, what do you feel is your sort of dominant conflict style? And remember, this isn't like none of these things are a description of personality. It's just the style we tend to, most tend to use in conflict or where there's a risk of conflict. Yeah, Anka.
I think I have done all of them in some way, in different situations with different people. It's kind of also like the encounter, reading the situation, the context, and then like without choosing, I tend to maybe jump on what feels more doable for me. Like if something is really pissing me off, I might be adversarial or something. If something is really pissing me off, but I don't have any option to do something about it, I might do something passive aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I might avoid something if it's just too scary. And I usually my normal thing is accommodating. So I think I can see all of them in my behavior. And also maybe sometimes I'm ashamed of it, or sometimes I feel critical about it. But often also I feel like, yeah, that was actually, if I reflect on it, if I get a chance to notice and reflect, I might often really think like, well, actually next time I would like to have the courage to say something or do something different. But actually for the moment, it was really the best option for me. Like even, for example, being passive aggressive rather than avoidant feels sometimes better to me than, you know, like try to force myself to do the perfect conversation, which I can't in the moment.
Yeah, love that. And you know, this is, I think, where for me, where we get to a really healthy conflict style is when we can take the intelligence and the benefits of all of those four styles and use them as a kind of like, what's required here, rather than conflict, avoid. Conflict, accommodate. How can I make this easy for you? Or conflict, let's go to war. Yeah. So that's great. And the thing you mentioned, Anka, is about the kind of tendency around accommodation. You know, a lot of that is about getting out of that mode is about experimenting with other ways. So I always recommend for clients who have that accommodating style and they're in that place of feeling frustrated or resentful, you know, what are the boundaries that you want to have in place? What are the, where's the line here about what's okay and not okay for you? And let's workshop some ideas of what you could say to that person. Usually there is like one context that they're kind of concerned about. For coaches, it's things like having absolutely no business boundaries in place, right? Like accommodators who are in business tend to burn out quick because there's no boundaries. There's no limits. You can contact me at any time. There's no, you know, you don't have to pay me until you're ready. Like all of it is just, it's so, and that erodes trust with the client because you're kind of, there's no like container. So it's like, what is the boundaries? What are the boundaries that you want to experiment with? You know, what's the most doable step you can take to play with this? And then it's like, oh, okay, I've done that. And I've got some ideas of what I can say if people question it. I'm good. Ooh, I've got some evidence now that it's possible for me to do this. Anyone else want to add in, like, what are you sort of feeling into in terms of your conflict style?
I think I have kind of what you were just saying in the sense of I've learned that maybe my younger ways of screaming and shouting weren't actually the way forward, and that's, I think, where I've become more accommodating. I think when I reflect, certainly within my marriage, my husband is a complete avoider. I.e. a sulker.
So right.
He'll take himself away. If something becomes an argument for us, he'll take himself away. And that would then make me more combative in the past. And I think I've come to learn that that's just, it's not healthy and it's not working. And I suppose the accommodator in me has been the one that's adjusted and changed more than necessarily maybe him.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that those different dynamics and how you then kind of maybe it feels more healthy for me to be more accommodating than to stamp my feet and be a drama queen or whatever, as you said.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love that. Well, even just that self-reflection, like, this doesn't feel great. And I think that's often because most of us don't have conflict modeled well for us. We sort of go, well, the alternative is the opposite. So adversarial people become deeply accommodating or avoidant, because it's kind of like, what else can I do, right? and so just even seeing, oh, where is that irritation kicking in that is, you know, can happen with all of us? And then what is that about? Because often anger is, I don't know if you've ever come across the Gottman Institute's anger iceberg.
It's not me for once.
Am I back?
Yep, you're back.
I think I'm back. Sorry, don't know what happened there. Gottman's anger iceberg shows us how anger can be the top presenting emotion, and then underneath it is all kinds of stuff. Grief, longing, loss, a sense of fear, like all kinds of emotions get present first as anger. And so it can be really great to just kind of go with, you know, sit with, what is that irritation? What's the thing that is actually happening? And sometimes I think when it's with our clients, it can be something like, oh, I'm actually anxious because the client is going to leave without a solution. If they keep talking, you know, if they don't shut up, they're going to leave without a solution. And I better offer some advice, or I better instruct them on what to do, right? So we get that irritation that then kind of leads us to say, well, you should do this, rather than staying in our healthy adult self and going, oh, okay, I'm noticing some
ladies, I have to jump off, I'm afraid, so I'll see you next week.
Oh. Sorry, thanks, Kirsty. Okay. Cheers. Apologies for the slight glitches. Don't know what that's about. So where we want to get to with this is a place of acceptance where we can kind of lead all potential conflict from our healthy adult self. And of course, this is going to be imperfect, right? Like, it's not, there's no points. There's no points or prizes. But the idea is, it's like, oh, can I lean into the strength and the intelligence of the different styles, like the humor of a passive aggressive style, the compassion of an accommodator, the assertion of an adversarial style, and the empathy of an avoider? Like, can I lean into those aspects? And it's like, what is this, you know, what is this context calling for? What would I be willing to experiment with? And the thing is, it's super hard to do that in the moment. So we often need to say, just need a moment to kind of figure out what I want to say or do. And usually that means we have to feel our feelings first. Because when you come to conflict and you're regulated and you're kind of calm and sort of present, and you have a sense of what it is you want out of this situation, then the conflict gets to be super productive. It's when we react from the emotional kind of drivers, that's when we usually start saying and doing things that we think later, not my proudest moment. So I'm just going to try and, oh gosh, my computer is doing all kinds of weird things today. Sorry, folks. So one of the things I would really love folks to do is to get kind of interested in your own like history with conflict, your own experience of it. What have you learned about conflict from your family, from your workplaces, from your key relationships? This helps you to start to see what was maybe the role or the style that you needed to play to stay safe in particular contexts. And the idea here is that you start to see, oh, my natural conflict style, the one that I tend to lean on the most, is simply my protector coming up and helping me stay safe. It's a habit of protection, of beliefs and behaviors, much like any other form of self-doubt. And it's something that we can experiment with, we can play with. We can, like Anka was describing, kind of flex into, well, am I just pissed off? What am I pissed off about? What do I want to ask for here? What's my request? And sometimes we might need a few moments to gather that. And then it's like, oh, I'm going to actually take that really beautiful intelligence of an adversarial style and just be direct. Really clear. Makes it so much easier for people to say yes or no. And this can be great to chat about in your practice pods, because you may be finding that there are, like, even amongst your pod, unspoken conflicts, right? About, oh, that's working. Sorry, I don't know if you heard that. I just can notice my computer's glitching a little bit. But yeah, there may be unspoken conflicts within your practice pod. So even just saying, can we check in through the lens of conflict, right? Where is there things that are or aren't working for people? And that's the number one question I'll ask a client. What's okay for you and what's not okay for you? When it comes to conflict, let's just think about it like that. And then we get to decide, okay, what do we want to do about that? Like, you know, what is it that you actually want? And then what's the best way to either get that or get something approximating that? Yeah, Anka.
Like, one thing I like about your model is that there are self-love, self-acceptance, and so on. And I feel like those are the shadow part of conflict. So basically, you know, the other side of it. Like, I feel like I can accept a style as a method if I also can accept myself in it and love and, you know, believe in it. And so basically have fluidity around it, not have to tiptoe, oh my God, I don't want to be adversarial or I don't want to be passive. I should not be that. Like, but that I can feel in my, like you just described, I can feel in myself what I feel and then kind of have the space in my own psyche to choose a style. And I think, like, learning more about my tendencies of conflict, yes, and but also my tendency of how do I respond internally to a style or to my behavior, and do I have the space to move that way or not? That's the other side of it, right?
Yeah, and it really is kind of inverting our natural tendency. Our natural tendency is, how do I get out of this bad feeling? And then we just kind of do that. We take whatever action it requires. Whereas this is saying, oh, notice there's something that is off here. What's off? What's not okay for you? What is it that you do want? And what's the best or, you know, most appropriate way in this context to ask for that or to go get that or express that or whatever it requires? But rather than kind of stay in that place of, I've just got to avoid the bad feeling. And that's one of the reasons why when we're working with conflict styles and talking about the fears of, you know, rejection and judgment and all of that stuff with our clients, part of this is recognizing that all of these psychological risks are feeling states. We don't want to feel rejected. We don't want to feel criticized. We don't want to feel judged. So the more we can accept, oh, I'm being judged. I feel judged. Okay. Can I sit in that feeling of being judged? And then what is that telling me? What's the message from that feeling? What is it that I want to take from that? Do I want to respond? Do I want to ignore the person? Do I want to do something else? And all of this, a lot of this comes down to the level of trust in the relationship. So if it's a stranger on the internet who's judging you, you may just want to go, yeah. If it's your partner, you're probably more likely to have a conversation. So all of this is about, you know, bringing in those, you know, those healthy self resources, right? The self-acceptance that, okay, can I accept that this is the feeling state I have? This is the need I have. You know, the willingness to advocate for yourself as part of self-worth, the discernment to know what to do, you know, as part of self-trust, and the, you know, ability to go, oh, what's the value here that I'm trying to express, or the intention that I want to express as part of self-belief. So it's like, oh, those things work together to get you to the outcome that you're actually looking for. And there's no guarantee you're going to get the outcome, right? But it's all about, like, how do you support yourself to get to where you're going? And when we can start to kind of bring that together for the clients so that they can see that they're actually, just because it feels a bit rough, doesn't mean something's gone wrong. They don't have to make themselves wrong. Yeah, it's just that maybe this is the first time they've ever slowed down and looked at the feeling of being criticized and the sting of that judgment, or the crunchiness of being criticized. If this is the first time you've actually slowed down and allow yourself to feel it, knowing that you can feel it, and then you can respond in a when you feel a bit more regulated, then that's incredibly powerful. It means that you're starting to diffuse that fear of criticism. Yeah. So what I recommend is that you explore a bit more about your own history with conflict. Get a bit reflective on it and just notice what is it that you might avoid or accommodate. Where do you get adversarial? Where do you get passive aggressive? Where does that come from? Because it won't be by accident, right? And then have a look at some of the tools in this module around how we actually coach people. And we're going to talk a bit more about that next week around the sort of three main tools. Yeah. But I think the number one thing to take away from this module is the more comfortable you are when you're talking about conflict, the more benefits you're going to be able to offer your clients, because you won't be entangled with them or with the people that they're in conflict with. Yeah. Any questions, thoughts, things that are coming up? Yeah.
I just ask myself, if I have a client who is, for example, very aggressive or very passive or whatever, and it shows up in or also avoiding, like, kind of stuck in one of those, like, how would you work with them? Like, they don't know about it. They just saw all the stories why things are not, and this is not, and this is not. It's like a kind of very narrow situation they are in. They feel they are in, basically because of how they are working. How do you start working with this, untangling this? Like, we can't just tell them and we don't even know. But yeah, I think this is quite difficult for me.
What, well, do you have a client in mind? Is there a client you're thinking of?
Not really, but I avoid people who are very like tough. I would not want to work with them. And I once, the only story I have, if you need one, is like, I had a psychotherapist who was like basically talking about how abandoned she feels because her clients didn't come back to her after her 6 months leave. And I was like, oh my God, I don't even know this is so off for a psychotherapist to feel abandoned because their client who she had left for 6 months are not coming back. I was kind of stuck. I didn't know what to do. And that to me was like a very avoidant thing, like very blind, not to see what actually is going on there. And I don't know if that helps.
So it really depends on the client. Like, and that's why I love like specific clients, right? So in the case of your client who was feeling abandoned, I would be asking questions around that. Tell me about abandonment. So one of the things we do in this module is go through like the emotion cycle. So I will encourage clients to go through that. So your client, and the reason I'm suggesting we start there is because that's where the client started. I feel abandoned. And it's like, would you like to explore that? Would you like to explore that sense of abandonment? We can kind of feel into that and see what it offers us as a way to look at what's happening here. And if the client's like willing to do that, and you can take them through the feelings wheel, just slow it all down, look at, okay, tell me about abandonment. Can you kind of feel into that? And where do you notice it in your body? What happens? Like, what colors do you see? What, if you could reach into your body and touch that emotion, what would it feel like? It's amazing the metaphors that folks will offer up. And you're just slowing it all down, giving them the ability to be with that feeling. And then, you know, naming it, okay, is this abandonment? Is there anything else here? Is there other emotions around this? Are there memories that are coming up, right? When else have you felt abandoned, kind of thing? What does this remind you of? And it's without kind of leading the witness, if you like, but it's more, let's get all the raw material out so that we've got a sense of what's happening here. And then, you know, asking that feeling, what's the message? Why are you here right now? And sometimes for those really tricky emotions, it's, I need you to feel me. And don't abandon me, right? Don't abandon yourself is often the thing that comes out of abandonment. And so sometimes just taking a person through that feelings wheel, it's like, oh, what do we make it mean that this has happened, right? And I don't have to avoid all of this. What can I do? What do I want to do? Right? So it's almost like we will have a tendency to want to fix the thing. And usually there is a piece about processing the thing when it comes to conflict. Yeah. Equally, when your clients rock up and you just mentioned, Anka, you know, that you sort of feel a bit taken aback by the tough guys, you know, the ones that have a real adversarial nature. And it's like, you know, sometimes I will, because the confrontation thing is a language they understand. Sometimes I'll say, wow, gosh, I feel a bit braced right now, like just being in your presence. I'm wondering, like, do you feel a bit braced? Am I picking up on that? You know, like just mirroring it back. Right, it's almost like I've got to have some armor on to have this conversation. Do you feel that? Do you have armor on? What's that made of? Right, so you're kind of mirroring it back. It's and this is the thing, is what happens when we sort of neutralize our own conflict styles and we get to a place where we can accept. We can sort of flex into wherever the client is and offer a way to partner with them so that they can be more in their own experience and sort of witness it themselves. So yeah, I don't know if that helps you, but yeah, that's what's coming
up. I just wanted to reflect back because I feel like I see a little bit like a middle place of mirroring. Like, I don't have to know what they have. I can use it as a lens to assess it a little bit, and then I can ask back, like, I feel this and this, like for example with a confrontative person, like to reflect back, like my sensation, like to be a little bit vulnerable on my side, because I say what I sense and I risk that they then like blow up because, oh no, never, whatever, you know. But to just, I would be not the first person who does that, who shows them, or that they feel the people are responding braced or like avoidant or kind of nervous, a little bit fearful or so, like to them. And that invites a conversation, which is what coaching is. I'm not there to be a comforting nurse or something. I'm there to be kind of a little bit like a person to have a real discussion with, a real conversation with. So the mirroring part is kind of a really beautiful middle place to land if I don't know where to go, to just use what I sense and feedback this to them and then see where we are going from there, right?
Absolutely. And the thing that happens then is all you're doing is letting your client witness themselves, which is incredibly powerful, because what you're doing is creating some safety. So often for the folks who are a bit adversarial, because they don't get to do that, they're constantly braced. No one will point that out to them because everybody is avoiding their ire. For you to just gently point out, hey, I kind of feel a bit braced around you, a bit like I need my armor on. What's that like to hear? What do you feel right now? Like, let me in, you know? Often we're doing the bravest thing possible because we're reflecting that to the client how other people perceive them. They may not know. They may feel like, you know, this is the way they have to be. In fact, you know, I'm just mindful of the few clients where I've done that with, because I'm like, just name it. Name what's in the room. It's like, you can't go wrong. Almost 100% of the time in supervision, when someone's like, what do we do about this dynamic? It's like, just name it, right? Name it with the client in a way that feels good to you. And I think about the men, particularly the men that I've worked with who have had that kind of style. And they've often been, you know, in quite like leadership positions where they've had quite a lot of responsibility, and they're just a bit flummoxed by it all, we will often have a conversation about, this is how to be a man. This is how to be a leader. This is what's expected of me. And underneath it, there is this boy who is like, what the hell is happening? I don't know. I don't want it. I want to go and play. I want to do something creative. I want a hug. I want, you know, and you start to see the whole armor thing is just a front. It's literally the protector on show.
And I just hear that's a kind of an invitation to do the belief buster, for example, right? Or elements of it, yeah, to continue, yeah, in some way.
Yeah, could be. Even just saying, what was that like? Who taught you that? You know, where did you learn that you had to be tough all the time? What's that like for you? You know, I can't even tell you how many times that has just led to tears. Just the release. This is a conversation I can have with you. I'm never going to meet you in person. We never have to talk about, you know, it's the safe container where I get to actually let this out, you know. I have had a conversation with a guy who was in his office and he had quite a release, like a tearful release. And someone knocked on his door and walked in, and he said, get out. Like, he really yelled at the person. He was really embarrassed about what they may have seen. I don't honestly think they were in the office long enough to experience. And he was quite embarrassed then that he had yelled at the person in front of me. And I was like, it's okay. But he never got back in touch with me after that. It was like, it was too much. It was too vulnerable. And I, you know, I wrote to him and I let him know that it was okay and I totally understood, and, you know, that we could change our time if he wanted to do it outside of work, and that I was really proud of him for, you know, feeling safe enough to express himself, and that, you know, all of the stuff that you would do. And it was just too much. He was like, oh no, there's a too big a price to pay, right? And so, you know, I just send him off with love and let him know that there's always a spot here if he needs to come back, you know. And this will sometimes happen, right? It's like we're just there to walk alongside our clients for as long as they need us or want us there, you know. And conflict's tender for so many people. It's a really tender thing. So, yeah, I just really encourage you to just reflect on your own relationship with conflict in the whole spectrum of it. Judgment, confrontation, criticism, all of the stuff, right? The difficult combos that you've had in your life. How's that gone? What have you learned? What are your beliefs around conflict? And then you start to see there might be themes and patterns, and how is that maybe showing up in your work? How does that kind of leak into your practice? And then when we meet next week, we can talk more about working with clients. But yeah, beautiful questions, Anka. Love it. Yeah. Hope that was helpful. Cool. All right, my loves. I will, I'll see you next week. I'll see you on Wednesday, Cassie.
I know. I was like, oh, is that the time already?
I know. Bad. All right, loves. Take care of yourselves, okay. And we'll see each other soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.